do you think neurodiversity and the questions around that and more sort of a focus on mental health will come part of baseline testing in possibly a SCAT in the future?
The first thing is to make sure you know your athlete. That's what Lee was saying. And the more you can establish background information on that athlete, the better off you're going to be when it comes to evaluating them post-concussion.
Welcome to the SASMA podcast, your source for the latest insights in sports medicine. Designed for healthcare professionals, we cover everything from injury prevention to athlete performance and mental health, helping you stay informed and excel in your field. Let's dive in.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the SASMA podcast. Today, I'm fortunate enough to be joined by two leaders in sport and exercise medicine and concussion work, namely Professor John Patricios and Dr. Lee Gordon, who have both recently attended the Concussion in Sport Group conference in Milwaukee. So to get us going, John, could you just please tell us, what is the CISG and what do they stand for?
CISG, Concussion in Sports Group, is a multidisciplinary international organization that is really vested in generating information, research, and clinical outputs around sport-related concussion. It's a group that was formed informally in 2002 after the first international consensus conference on concussion in sport. And essentially for the last couple of decades has been responsible for organizing the consensus conference, which has taken place every 4 years. And what's happened more recently in the last 6 or 7 years is that CISG has become more organized, is now formally registered not-for-profit association in Delaware in the United States, and has a board, has a constitution, and now is more about the way it goes about researching concussion and generating sport-related concussion clinical outputs.
Brilliant. And I see that the symposium had a title, namely From Consensus to Clinic Advances in Practical Applications from the Amsterdam Conference or consensus from a few years back. So can you tell us a little bit more, what was the symposium actually about?
So as I mentioned, CISG has really got together mostly every 4 years in the build-up to the consensus conferences, and that has usually started about 18 to 24 months out. So what's happened is there's been a bit of a lull between the conferences. So what CISG, now that it's more formalized, has taken on is to generate more educational outputs between the consensus conferences. And this was the first attempt at doing that. Obviously, because funds are an issue, the strategy is to tag on to existing meetings. So in this case, the Sports Neuropsychology Society of North America was holding a conference in Milwaukee. And because there's similarity in the themes, CISG tagged onto that meeting and generated a day and a half symposium. The idea was really to look at the Amsterdam outputs, see how well those were being implemented, and then to update the attendees on the research that had taken place since the Amsterdam Consensus Conference, which was in October 2022. So it's seen as a stepping forward in terms of generating more knowledge translation, stimulating more research, making sure that clinicians stay together and communicate more regularly between the consensus conferences. And I think Lee's going to comment on that now, I'm sure, but I think they were successful in doing that.
Brilliant. Thanks, John. As I can imagine, it was a jam-packed day and a half. There's quite a lot to update on. Lee, could you highlight for our listeners what were the main key take-home points that you took from the day there?
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. So for me, it was an exciting symposium to attend because it was the first meeting of CISG that I've attended in person. And I found it wonderful to be able to meet in person all the names that you've seen on all the documents and actually meet them in person and chat to them. So for me, that was a highlight. In terms of the actual conference we had, what struck me is John particularly did a beautiful talk on the tools and essentially how far we've come in the last 20 years from developing tools to assess concussion and what huge progress we've made in that. And part of that also to highlight to our listeners is how many of our tools have already been translated into different languages. Those are culturally appropriately translated or adapted, one would say. So that was one of the first highlights, is actually seeing how much work has been done in making those tools available to larger parts of the world population. And then really it was, if you think about what the consensus was, we had our systematic reviews, which had taken all the evidence up until that point, and then highlighted the areas where research and literature is missing. And what was so exciting about this symposium is that so many of those areas were addressed. And for me, those are the areas that I find challenging in my personal practice. So personally, some of the highlights were talks on looking at return to learn processes and the challenges and the barriers that clinicians experience in supporting learners through return to learn process. It was the first time I've ever attended a talk on concussion and neurodiversity. Should we be treating them differently? And the answer is yes, in terms of, especially with baselines, we need to think more carefully about how we assess these patients, because they're obviously we manage concussion according to changes from baseline. And if our baseline is not accurate, that's going to affect the way we manage them. So that was a really interesting talk. And there are quite a few tools that came out of there. There's a Virginia Institute for Neurodiversity Concussion Assessment. So that was fascinating. So that's been highlighted as, you know, an area of research, as has concussion in para athletes. We had some talks about that. We spoke about persisting symptoms, which I think is a big part of managing student athletes, especially adolescent athletes. And we had quite a few talks on that. And for me, what was born out was actually what I see in clinical practice, is that those patients that are challenging to manage or your younger female athletes, and especially those with underlying mood disorders and anxiety, what came up was as one of your trait, as one of your risk factors for persistent symptoms, was perfectionism in the athlete and stress in the parent, which is what we see in practice, but it was interesting to see it actually kind of being borne out in the literature. And then just to finish off, I think one of the most interesting bits of new literature or research was into driving after concussion, because there's been very little in that space. That what it essentially that research is showing, that in those first 48 to 72 hours, there are definitely deficits in driving ability, which one needs to take into account when one sees patients. So I think that's an overall in terms of my highlights and what I took out of the conference. I'm sure John would look at it from different eyes. I'm not sure if he would have some different ones as well.
So that's absolutely fascinating, Lee, especially the language tools, like if we talk about South Africa and the multiple languages we have in practice there. And then to neurodiversity, I must say, is one of the biggest challenges I'm finding when doing baseline testing. We'll move on. We'll chat about those points maybe a little bit more in depth. But John, just to add to that, I know you were one of the speakers, but was there anything that you can highlight from the symposium?
I think Lee did an outstanding job of picking the highlights that I would have as well. I think in terms of themes, for me, there was a consistent theme that it's not a one-size-fits-all, that you have to really tailor your approach in terms of the athlete that you're dealing with and their environment and their support teams and their external stresses, all of which play a role. As one starts out in clinical sports concussion practice, it's quite tempting to take a template, be it the SCAT 6 or the SCOT 6, and just work through it systematically. And the qualitative aspect of assessments came through time and again. And Lee's pointed some of those out in terms of the modifiers like depression and external stresses of being a sports person, anxieties, be it in the athlete or in their parents, and neurodiversity as well. So that for me was a consistent theme. And what was really nice was to see some of the research that's taken place in these areas in the last 2 years. And I'm hoping by the time we have the next consensus meeting that we'll have some really tangible outputs on things like driving after concussion, treating a neurodiverse athlete, etc. So I think there's some really useful stuff coming out. And then in terms of cutting edge stuff, the work on biomarkers seems to be reaching a threshold where perhaps it might be commercially viable in the next few years. Probably not one biomarker, but a suite of biomarkers which might help us to diagnose concussion, monitor recovery, et cetera. So that was another area where there were a couple of good talks. So those were really the themes. And for me, it was really nice to see those evolving between consensus meetings and to see that although we're on a sound footing, there are developments taking place in each of those areas.
Excellent. I mean, the biomarkers, I think, is something that we're all looking into, and having something that's tangible and easily accessible will be the dream. And hopefully we'll get there and we can touch on that a bit more. Lee, just from what you've previously and just mentioned, anything you would have taken home that you would change your clinical practice today or tomorrow when you're seeing patients with a concussion?
So for me, actually, one of my challenges that no one's really been able to answer me well on before was, how do we manage our athletes who are on stimulants in a concussion, like in an acute concussive phase? And this came up in our neurodiversity talk, because you're trying to rest your patient's brain and trying to rehab it back into a state where it's back into normal function, but you don't want to overload it. So question of using a stimulant, like, how is that going to affect your brain function? And I think we've had varied inputs in terms of, do you keep them off their stimulants until their symptoms are significantly almost gone, or do you keep them on them? The interesting comments that we made were, actually, you've got, as your brain is using glucose and is using it at a much higher rate in terms of recovery, you want to try and reduce that brain's workload. So by using a stimulant, you may be reducing the workload and therefore facilitating kind of a return. So if they are able to go to school and or university, then you need to try and make it as easy for them to study as possible. So to keep them on those meds. So for me, that was a practice changing event, because it gives me a clearer guideline in terms of how to work with these young athletes really, and young students.
I mean, that's probably one of the other big challenges when you're dealing with student athletes. And I guess that also then ties into the return to learn discussion and where that all fits in, and how to either not necessarily quicken the recovery or just slow it down, or just to make sure that everything is optimal for that athlete. If we go back to the neurodiversity, it's something that I've looked at for, you know, baseline testing. What type of questions would you include in your baseline testing when you're assessing for possible changes there?
So I think it was Catherine McGill who did the talk on that. And really, it's in terms of really looking at the way you baseline assess these athletes, you want to know your athlete. You want to see what is their usual pattern of communication. How do they usually express themselves? What's their verbal preference? What are nonverbal cues that are normal for them? And you need to think about how quick the pace of how you are assessing them, and how long the test is, and how complex they are. And then in terms of how they've changed, some of the suggestions were looking at patterns of changes in behavior in the children. So what has their level of independence changed? Has their stamina changed? Appetite and sleep patterns, that would be similar to a non-neurodiverse athlete. But looking at remembering what, if a lot of them are routine-based, upsetting their routine is going to cause a lot of symptoms anyway. So knowing what your patient's routines are and what upsets them, and trying to avoid those. And also, one of the key things that came out were, if in a neurodiverse patient, what's the way that they chill themselves? How do they calm themselves down when they are anxious? And knowing what that pattern is, then to introduce it when they need to take a break, when they're injured. So if they're in their cognitive load management, they need to take a break, then they can use those tools that they already know, but then they are kind of almost like a CBT type picture, that they know then to use those self-soothing tools to calm themselves down. So part of it was your language and the way you assess at baseline, but also looking for different things in injury and potentially how to manage those differently.
So that's, again, I mean, fascinating, because that ties right into the holistic and individualized approach to your players. And I've got a two-part question for you, John. One is, do you think neurodiversity and the questions around that and more sort of a focus on mental health will come part of baseline testing in possibly a SCAT in the future, or are there discussions around this?
The first thing is to make sure you know your athlete. That's what Lee was saying. And the more you can establish background information on that athlete, the better off you're going to be when it comes to evaluating them post-concussion. So just a good understanding of that athlete's medical, neurological, and psychological history, the medications they've been on in the past, any therapies they've had, will give you an advantage in terms of evaluating that athlete. The second part is then to put them into a structured process and to let them know that there's a way forward. And that's another always try and highlight is that there's no visible wound. Now, for someone who's already got issues related to thought patterns, energy levels, etc., that can be very, very frightful. And to put them into an environment that's structured and to be able to explain to them that they're going to go through a process which is going to help them reestablish their thought processes and their function is hugely comforting. And that's what the protocols we have for. But to be able to explain that in a way that's understandable is a clinical skill. And yes, there are aspects which have already crept into our evaluations. So not quite the field side evaluations yet, although the SCAT-6 does take into account medical and psychological history. But in the SCOTE-6, there are measures for sleep, anxiety, and depression, which are there. And I think if I was to revisit that now, I'd push up to the top of the evaluation in the history section, and I would also make it a compulsory rather than a recommended aspect of the evaluation, because it's become so important in terms of obtaining that background information. But increasingly appreciating that actually there's such a spectrum of neurodiversity that you should be exploring that with every athlete that you're assessing, because potentially it could have an impact on the outcome and on the way you evaluate and advise that athlete. So absolutely, that's becoming increasingly a part of our subjective and objective evaluation.
Absolutely. And I think, well, the second part of the question, and this one for you, John, again, is, so when you've got clinicians working in a team setting, or you've got, you know, batch testing of 60 athletes to do in a baseline, and you want to get all your SCATs done quickly, do you have any advice as to, you know, how can you increase your sort of individualization of each one when you're doing it on such a mass number?
So my advice is really not to rely on that 12 to 15 minute period that you're doing the SCAT-6, but to utilize every interaction you have with the athletes to glean information about them. So it's not a tick box exercise. It's just like doing a thorough medical pre-season evaluation. You have a certain amount of time, but you also incorporate as much knowledge that you have about the patient through your interactions with them at other times. And I think that's very, very important, is this concept of knowing your athlete. There's no one evaluation, one computerized test that's going to give you all the information you need. The better you know your athlete before they're concussed, the more likely it is that you'll make good decisions after they're concussed. So I know time is an issue in terms of dealing with teams, and the more familiar you are with that SCAT-6 evaluation, the slicker it will be. But there's no substitute for discussions beyond that and incorporating that into your understanding of the athlete, which I think is very, very important and something that's often lost.
Fantastic. Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think the more you emphasize it and the more you encourage knowing your patient beyond the tool, I think can only offer better care for the players. And lastly, just whilst we tie up this discussion, you both briefly mentioned some innovations and new research that will be coming out. Lee, if I could just ask you just to finish up with, what were you most excited about to come in the next couple of years after you attended the symposium?
So A, not in terms of biomarkers, but I think having clear driving guidance would be super helpful and super practical. But for me, I think one of my biggest challenges is how do you assess full recovery from a concussion? My sense is that the more we are seeing with the biomarkers, and as John said, it's not single biomarkers. We haven't found the holy grail, or kind of, as someone put it, we haven't found the troponin of concussion yet. But there's a collection of biomarkers that are looking promising. The other thing that's looking promising is cerebral blood flow changes, which are shown to be reduced in injury, and actually seem to be an indicator of recovery as well. And I have to say, what I'm seeing across, the more we know, the longer we're going to be seeing recoveries, because the more detailed knowledge we have of a concussion from a pathophysiological perspective is that we're actually seeing that recovery takes longer than we expected to. So my prediction is that we're going to get some great tools, but that may come along with longer return to play times, because we know that that brain is still recovering. And I think my final thing is actually not to do with all the new advances, but actually solid, good evidence. I'm trying to think the key. There was a lovely paper in terms of, if you do the basics properly, individualized care and looking at individualized athletes doing everything that one should in that athlete, the return to learn, the return to sport, if you have cervical rehab, if you need vestibular rehab, and they added in a pillar of cognitive behavioral therapy from a neuropsych perspective, those athletes did really well. So it wasn't anything fancy. It was actually just doing the basics well. And I think, you know, in terms of community concussion, we need to educate more of our clinicians across the board in terms of what are the basics and how to do them well. And that overall is going to have a better outcome. But the exciting stuff is the new research. But yeah, as I say, my fear is that going to be the more we know, the longer we're going to be keeping our athletes out.
I think that last point sums it up beautifully, and it links to clinical medicine and clinical practice. If you do the basics right and thorough with just the simple things, you know, you'll have a better outcome. So I think that's absolutely brilliant. And lastly, John, you know, you mentioned that there was this CISG symposium and the Amsterdam consensus was in 2022. What do the next few years look like in terms of when's the next consensus statement going to come out?
So interestingly, we'll probably decide that in the next 2 or 3 weeks, but it's probably going to be at least 2 years out from here. We're probably looking at 2027 will be the next consensus. But I also envisage a lot of development up until then. And Lee has highlighted some of those areas where there's a lot of work taking place. And I just want to highlight one other area, and that's in the area of parasport, which is one of the most complex areas to deal with because of the range of potential disabilities that you're dealing with. So assessing an athlete with a visual disability compared to an intellectual impairment compared to someone who isn't able to stand is very, very different. And that's an area that's taking place. There's a lot of research taking place in the background, especially by a group called the Concussion in Parasport Group. So we're working in parallel with them to try and generate a lot more research and practical clinical outcomes there. And together with all the areas that he has mentioned, better knowledge translation, more refined clinical protocols, and then some of the more exciting high-end technology, I think we'll see quite a lot of that coming to head in the next 2 years and hopefully presented in 2027.
Brilliant. Thank you, John. And I think we could probably have a whole podcast series, and I think we probably should, on the different types of parasport and the different sort of challenges you'll have when managing patients with concussion and players in those sports. So lastly, I just wanted to thank both of you for giving your time to the organization, and we really appreciate you taking the time to share your insights, and we look forward to having you again on the podcast really soon. So thank you guys, and all the best. We'll all talk soon.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks very much for having us.